And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee. At Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I am joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and coming up any week now, the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. So Doug, how the heck are you? Real baseball is getting close, my friend, just a couple of weeks away.
Ooh, man, it's exciting. And actually, I'm on spring break. He's a professor. Oh, yeah. So otherwise, normally I'd be about to start class in about 20 minutes. So, but yeah, UConn's on break and, you know, kids scattering around. And so we'll be back next week. But yeah, I'm excited. It's, you know, I could feel it. The weather's, you know, getting moments of some 50 degree days, which is beautiful when you're growing up in New Jersey. And because March 8th used to be our first day of spring training for baseball in the high school days. So, let's go. MLB, here we come.
Good to hear. Keep the temperatures up, please. That's all I ask of you.
Yes.
Hey, we have another really fun show coming up today. Mike Elias, the GM who built those insanely talented Baltimore Orioles, will join us. There's great trivia, of course. And Doug is going to do some amazing storytelling, as he always does, in the dugout segment, which I look forward to every darn show. But Doug, first I wanted to tell you about my day yesterday, Monday, because it has a connection to the dugout segment, which we'll get into later. I spent the day following Joey Votto around on his first full day as a Toronto Blue Jay, or wherever he is now since he's on a minor league contract. It's like, were you a Yankee when you were in a Yankee camp on a minor league contract, or were you a Columbus Clipper?
Yeah. No, I was a Yankee. Non-roster invite, but I was still a Yankee.
All right, good to know. So you know, I basically followed Joey around for the day, and that guy is so thoughtful and so interesting and so much fun to talk to. I hope everybody takes a few minutes to read this, you know, just because it's a chance to let those Joey Votto vibes wash over you. Nobody thinks about the baseball life and expresses it better than Joey. So I know you'll have some thoughts later from your own experience about what this is like when we get to that dugout segment, but I just wanted to tell one quick story because it was so classic. So he needs to take some live batting practice. Okay, so he's bouncing around on the backfields, field to field, taking live BP against a bunch of minor league pitchers. And he's facing a guy, I'll admit, I never heard of. He's a right-handed pitcher named Eric Pardino. So mostly, Joey's just up there. He's just tracking pitches, not swinging. But now he gets to 1-2 on this guy, and he swings through a fastball. And so this guy who threw it, he runs off the field and he tells everybody, "I just struck out Joey Gallo." Okay, but oh, he did. That's not quite the same thing as striking out Joey Votto, right? But it was so funny. Everybody just cracked up. So I looked up Eric Pardino, and it turns out he's from Brazil, where I'm guessing Joey Votto is not quite as big a household name as he is in Canada, but it was just so classic, right? It just got me curious. If you had a moment like that in baseball or even outside of baseball where, like, you're Doug Glanville, famous baseball player, and yet nobody had any idea who you were or what your name was. Did that ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, Joey Votto, what a career. And, you know, I always have a lot of memories this time of year, especially as you get towards the end of the spring. And it's a time where you're like, well, you know, am I going to make this team? You know, you go through that period. You go through the period early on where you're excited. I was traded to the Phillies, you know, from the Cubs in the offseason. I'm like, you know, now I'm looking forward. But as you get older, in the Joey Votto scenario, you think about what happens at the latter part of your career, and you're holding on, you can't find a job. I got released by the Yankees, for example, and had a couple of offers. They were minor leagues. So you start to be confronted with, like, this could be it. And Votto's played, you know, much longer than most, but even for him, it's still a challenge. So I always think of one thing about, you know, the fear of anonymity, right? The idea that one day you'll be forgotten. I remember talking to Reggie Jackson in spring training in 2005, and he's like, you know, talked about this fear of being forgotten.
Reggie Jackson had a fear of being forgotten. Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he was in camp, you know, he used to be working out all the time. He did his planks and he was in great shape. But he was always kind of figuring out, like, you know, how do I keep this going? I asked the same question of Derek Jeter in Cuba. And he was surprised that, you know, Reggie felt that way. But it's different when you're on the other side, as Jeter is now. Now you start thinking. But one funny story about being forgotten was at one point, you know, you have to deal with the fact that you're getting farther removed from the game. Like, even if you're around as a broadcaster, whatever, you know, you're just not in the clubhouse in the same way. And so one off season, my wife and I, we'd moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. And, you know, my wife was pregnant with our third. And so we were just hanging out Halloween. And my wife is incredible at sewing costumes. And she does this for school plays and local plays. So she's really good. And so we said, well, who are we going to go as? It was a costume party. We were going with friends. We went with the Invisible Man and Wonder Woman. And I was like, what are we going to do? And I hadn't thought about anything. And my wife usually comes up with the ideas. So she decides that she's going to sew a costume of a kind of a wicked witch. Because she said, well, I have the belly, and I want to make that look like a cauldron, and then I'm a witch coming out of the top. So she sewed this costume with the brim of the cauldron. It looked really cool, and it was decked out. It took her like days to sew, got, you know, ordered fabrics and all that, and she goes. Now, come to find out, there's a competition at this Halloween event, and it's downtown Raleigh, and you could win like $200 gift card, and they did it by category. So I was like, yeah, that's cool. So last minute, I said, you know what? I'm going to go as myself, right? You know, so why not, right? I mean, I remember Peyton Manning saying the best disguise you could ever have is wear your own jersey in the mall. And then it's like, that can't be Peyton Manning. So I decided to go in uniform. I said, well, let me spice it up to make it put a little bit of effort into this. I decided that I was going to, you know, I played in the PED era. So I decided I'm going to make myself a steroidal version of Doug Glanville. So I took I had my Texas Rangers uniform. I stuffed my clothes with shirts. So I got myself all bulked out, right? I was humongous. I actually had a syringe sticking out of my neck, kind of like a fake one, of course. I had a giant bottle of vitamins called Biggin's. I got that from Jim Tomey. He said, how you doing, Biggin? So I had the Biggin jar. And then I took a copy. I took a baseball card at the Rangers, and I blew it up at Kinko's, huge. And then I doctored all the statistics on the back. So one year I hit 110 home runs, and I had all these stats, right? So I wore this around my neck, and I go to the costume party, and I'm like, okay. So people are looking. They're kind of like, and I know I'm not necessarily a household name in Raleigh, but baseball fans, if I'm wearing my uniform, pretty decent chance they would figure it out. Absolutely nobody. And so I go around, and then one person said, wait a minute, Glanville, are you his cousin? I got that. So I was like, no, I'm not his cousin. And I kept going. So I end up winning. I end up winning the costume award for my category. Right? So I go up to get my award. I'm in full uni. And now at this point, my muscles are falling off because I stuffed them with T-shirts. And I finally go and get my award. And people just won't believe me. So finally, I'm like, let me just let some people off the hook. It's like, no, I'm actually Doug Glanville. And they're like, nobody believed me. Literally nobody. It's like, no, no, no. So finally, I got somebody's like, well, if you're Glanville, why would you even be in Raleigh, North Carolina? Like, what are you doing here? Why would you be in Raleigh? I don't even understand that. So it finally took me to break out my driver's license to get actual confirmation. And the guy still didn't believe it until my wife broke out her license. He's like, well, would she also doctor her license up with my last name? So it took all kinds of proof. So anonymity and just obscurity is right around the corner. So Joey, I know you're fighting hard for this. You can't fight it forever. You Hall of Famer, it's going to be awesome. But it is hard, you know, just time marches on and you do what you can to stay close. I think in the end it's positive because I've been able to find a reinvention of myself even without wearing the PED stuffed shirt uniform.
That's beautiful. You think you're a household name, but would you please show some ID? Perfect. Okay, let's welcome in the man who oversaw the construction of the most exciting team that I know I've seen in spring training. It's Mike Elias, the general manager of those Baltimore Orioles. Mike, thanks for joining us here in Starkville.
Thanks for having me. Hi, guys.
All right. Hey, listen, your team, man, that they're just crushing it in the all-important Grapefruit League. Mike, I'm sure you've noticed this. You're 14-2 with a tie as we record this. 14-2. So if the Orioles were to keep this up all season, let's turn to Glanville here. Doug, you went to Penn. What would their record be?
Oh, boy, that's too much math in the engineering mind this early
okay,
in the
morning. Okay, well, there's 162 games
we'll
in a season. At 14 out of 16, that comes out to like 140-22 or something. What do you think, Mike? Does that seem doable?
I think Doug's other life experiences will tell him that spring training wins and losses aren't something that we look at too closely, but it's better than being 2-14 in spring training. That would be unpleasant, so we'll take it.
Yeah. Well, you know what I think it does reflect? Spring training records, to me, they don't always tell you how good your everyday players are, but they do tell you how good your prospects are and those minor leaguers that you send on the road. And like, you can match prospects with pretty much any team in the sport. Is that what you think this record reflects, at least to some degree?
I really don't know what to make of it. I've seen everything in spring training. I think my overall opinion about spring training performances, whether it's a team or a player, is good isn't necessarily good, but good is better than bad. And so, like I said, we're happy that we got some guys playing well. I think the main thing is getting out of here relatively healthy, getting the pitchers ramped up, hitters not being in horrible funks when they leave, although sometimes that happens and, you know, the guy goes 5-for-5 on opening day. So, we just try to sort of evaluating spring training. It's much more art than science for me and our manager, Brandon Hyde.
Yeah. Spring training is quite a phenomenon. We all know that. And here's one of the beautiful things about it that I see. When you're 2-14, or you're 1-47 at the plate, you can act like none of that is actually happening because you're working on something. It doesn't count. But when you're 14-2, people do get excited, both in your camp and in your town. Do you want them to get this excited, or do you need to temper those expectations, I don't know, just for the sake of being real?
No, I think it's great. I mean, we're a franchise that was dormant for a few years from like 2017 to 2021 as we were rebuilding the franchise. And, all of those years were during the rebuilding process, but 2017, 2018, before I got here, the Orioles were in a contending mode, but it just didn't go well. And then we sat back, we rebooted the entire franchise from the bottom up. And now, since 2022, we've been in a very competitive state. So we want to attract attention to this exciting young group of players that we have. They're wonderful human beings, too. And it's a really nice team to follow. And we want to have a lot of attention on it. So if this is helping with that, great. We brought in Corbin Burns this winter. You know, we've got Jackson Holliday in our camp, along with our established major league stars. So there's a lot to be entertained by and excited about watching this team. So I hope that the team drawing attention to itself this spring training happens.
Yeah, well, Mike, I mean, just thinking about the years in spring training, what's the difference in the tone and conversation when you walk around camp this year versus last
year? It's been for me at least, been a very noticeable, professional, upbeat vibe from the players. They seem really happy to be back under the same roof with one another. There's a lot of friendships on this team, and we had just a really pleasurable regular season, 101 wins. No long losing streaks, just everything went so smoothly during the regular season. And then we had a horrible playoff experience, got swept in the division series by the Rangers. It was over before we knew it. And you know what that's like. It's just tough to say, okay, everybody go home. And I think these guys are really happy to be back together and back to work. And there's been a confidence with our players around camp and a lot of smiles on people's faces. It's been really nice.
So, Mike, when you arrived from Houston, that was, 7 years ago, was this your vision? I know you talked at your first press conference about having an elite pipeline of talent, but have you even exceeded your own expectations?
You know, I'll be honest. You know, when we were sitting there in with the Orioles in last place in 2018, 115 losses, you kind of missing departments in the organization, international analytics, nothing going for us at that point in time. I knew that there were some internal players in the system, and I was right about that. We have a lot of guys that I inherited that are a big part of this team that were kind of percolating in the system when we walked into the door. But it just seemed impossible almost to pass all these great organizations in our division, and let alone win 100 games in the AL East. We knew we were going to push in the right direction, and we knew we were going to make the place a lot better, and we knew we were going to draft and develop well and install the right processes and people all around the organization. But in the American League East, it was so daunting looking that I can't say that any one of us articulated, okay, let's win the division in year five, or let's win 100 games. And, you know, it just kind of happened. And I think that's a testament to a lot of people getting together and pulling on the same rope.
Well, let me ask you that question that I know people ask you all the time, and that is, how similar is this process to what you lived in Houston when you were there? I understand you were the scouting director then, you're the GM now, but does it feel like you're following essentially the same script? And is that because it's essentially the same formula?
Well, I think we learned a lot in Houston, and a big part of that are some of the scouting and player development processes that we've more or less copied in Baltimore, or kind of brought that tree of scouting and player development with us. And that's combining a lot of baseball knowledge and a lot of scouting and coaching expertise, but with high tech and information and sort of data-driven processes and everything that we do, or at least everything where that lends itself. And I think that we combine those things really well. So that's what we're doing here that's similar to Houston, but also in terms of the rebuild and how difficult it is for everybody to go through a period where you're losing that many games. I think the experience there made it easier here, because we kind of knew that our methods tend to work and that there's likely light at the end of the tunnel. And I had also experienced and made a lot of mistakes in my participation in the Houston rebuild that, you know, you make a mistake, you learn from it. So I think we were able to sidestep some of the little mistakes or bad decisions that we made over the years in Houston by having that experience.
That's interesting. So what was one of those mistakes that you realized you just couldn't afford to repeat?
Well, I mean, some of it, it's all across the organization, but some of it, you know, something you do in the draft, or, you know, with an early pick, or the process that led you to an early pick and it didn't go well. Okay, let's improve the process next time. And by and large, our high picks in Houston did really, really well, but we had a misfire or two. And also just, you know, as new technology comes out, like baseball was changed very heavily in the middle part of the 2010s, mostly by TrackMan devices all around Major League stadiums that track the physical properties of the baseball, basically. And when that stuff was brand new, and we were pushing it out into the minor leagues and asking our players and coaches to use it for the first time, you experience feedback and dead ends and mistakes in the way that you go about that. And now we go to Baltimore 4 years later, we can kind of sprint to the correct approach without going through some of the turmoil, early turmoil that we did as we were easing into this this new technological world in baseball, but also sports, to kind of happen over the last 8 years. So it's been really interesting to be at the forefront of it. And I definitely personally, and I know Sig Meidel, our assistant GM, and other people that were in Houston benefited greatly from being a part of that very intense rebuild.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper Polo shirt is so breathable, you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech Chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima Crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew neck t-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
Well, Mike, I mean, you know, you mentioned the data dive, and you know, you have, you know, like a NASA engineer, I guess a SIG. So you have a lot of expertise in that analytics side, but you've also just hit the bullseye on those intangibles. I mean, you talk about first round picks and first picks overall, and so on. This level of prospect, you know, they've contributed right away. I mean, Jackson Holliday, you know, talking about the spring training. What do you think that has been to be able to actually marry the talent set and the skills to be able to find someone that actually is mature beyond their years where they're ready to contribute for pretty much day one?
You know, it's something that through scouting experience, I have increasingly come to put a lot of emphasis on. And so we spend a lot of time, especially with a high pick, but as much as we can, our scouts will sit down, get to know the players and their family. There's no science to it, but you do some legwork on that front, you tend to kind of get a sense in the correct direction of what a player's like, and we put a lot of stock into that. So We're very blessed here right now to have a lot of really conscientious, hardworking guys all across the organization. And I think it helps the players when you look to your left and your right and the guys working just as hard as you and looking out for the team and the organization like you are. I can't imagine that doesn't help the clubhouse culture. And right now, ours is really strong.
Well, let's go down that road talking about your picks. Because I was talking to an executive from another team this spring about your club, talking about all your incredible young players. And he said the biggest thing is that during the rebuild, they had all of those high picks, and they didn't miss. And it's so true. I started going through all your number one and number two picks. You had Avi Rutschman and Gunnar Henderson in the same draft. Keston Hjerstad and Colton Cowser and Jackson Holliday and Jordan Westberg and Connor Norby. So let's see, that's a rookie of the year. It's an MVP candidate. It's five top 100 prospects. All of those drafts in a row. Mike, is there a secret? You know, how can you be batting 1,000 on those picks? It's so hard to do.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed still. The baseball gods are always on my back and listening, and I've been a part of some disasters over the years, and I don't know. Our scouts did a good job the last few years, it's been nice. It's a relief when you have a high pick, you feel a lot of pressure, and it's hard. It's like maybe 50-50 that the pick's going to work out. And, it's a very high stakes thing for the franchise. So when you even get some semblance of success with them, it's honestly kind of a sense of relief. But these players are doing well. I'd point out, though, like that's for the future. I mean, the guys that you've named, Adley has had a huge impact on our major league team. And Jordan Westberg came up and had a nice second half debut. But the rest of them haven't really contributed yet. So This team from 2023 is not been furnished by high draft picks. It's been players either drafted by the previous regime or that we've pulled in from various avenues. And Adley was the only really high pick that contributed. Gunnar as a second rounder and Jordan Westberg, I think he was like a comp pick 30th overall. So we've still got those high picks kind of waiting in the wings, and that's what's been really exciting as you watch spring training is they're all out on the field now with the 2023 Orioles, and you're kind of seeing the present and future come together in spring training.
It is exciting. It's like watching the top prospects list like come to life while you're talking about them and reading about them. You mentioned Adley and Gunnar, and you got them in the same draft. Did you think that was possible going into that draft?
Well, I mean, we're picking 1-1, so we could pick whoever we want with the first pick. And
right.
Adley was kind of the chalk guy, but there were some other good choices. You know, Bobby Witt was there, and it wasn't a slam dunk, but we ultimately kind of started with Adley, did all of our work, and just sort of came back to Adley. And I think it was the right move on a number of levels for the franchise. But Gunnar Henderson, I was really surprised when he got to the 42nd pick. We probably had him like in the middle of the first round on our board. And there were like publications that had him going in the middle of the first round. He was relatively raw. He was a very young kid from a pretty rural part of South Alabama. And a really good athlete, and just nobody used their first round pick on him. And I wasn't entirely sure he was going to sign in the second round too. So we had to make a lot of intense phone calls before the pick, trying to get a sense of signability. And it wasn't a total slam dunk that he was going to sign. So I remember just pulling the magnet off the board. I mean, I hope we get lucky with this because we're going to need it. And I'd say that we did. So. Yeah. He's really a treat to watch right now, kind of growing into his young career. It's really fun watching on the field.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you know, both those guys are team changers. And I guess especially Adley, right? When Adley came up, it felt like everything changed with your club. What is it about Adley Rutschman that enabled him to have that kind of impact?
He's a very special player, but he's a very special person too. He's really got a very pure attitude and very respectful of other people. He's very positive. He's very focused. He's very smart. He's incredibly athletic. I mean, we watch him play baseball, but he was a college football player for a while before he shut it down to focus on baseball. And he's like fully ambidextrous basically with everything that he does. And he's just a very gifted person, but he also has an incredible work ethic. So you're getting all these gifts, but he's maxing himself out through his hard work. And it definitely makes the people around him better.
So Mike, when you have like a Rutschman behind the plate who has that kind of impact as a rookie and a young player that has to learn everything, right? You have to learn how to hit these pitchers. You have to learn it from the left and right side. You have to learn how to manage a staff. And then does it make it easier to go get Corbin Burnes, to get any pitcher, to feel like that pitcher is going to be in good hands, not only in the system, but with a young catcher that has that kind of aptitude?
Yeah, it's been awesome. We kind of first noticed, so Adley came up in 2022, and our team almost immediately started winning. We had a nice season in 2022, but it kind of platformed us into the offseason in 2023, where it's like, okay, we got to, you know, let's go. And so we had a lot of free agent conversations. And you noticed it when you were talking to the pitchers, Kyle Gibson or whomever. They were really curious about working with Adley. It was a draw for them. And then we also brought James McCann in. And he's been incredible for our pitching staff and our whole clubhouse and our team. So with the two of them, it's quite a combination, and it's absolutely a factor for our pitching staff.
Since Doug brought up the Corbin Burnes trade, if we're going to talk parallels between the Orioles and the Astros journeys, it's hard to escape the parallel between the Corbin Burnes trade, which you guys made this past winter, and that Justin Verlander deal in midseason in Houston. So when you get to that point, Mike, where you have literally more prospects than you can play, you can make trades like this. How similar do you view those trades and I guess those moments in time in the process?
It definitely struck me as a little bit similar. I mean, the Verlander trade, which I was, you know, I was the scouting guy. I wasn't terribly involved in that trade, but it was actually an August trade, but it was a mid-season trade. And he had, I believe, maybe 2.5 years left on his contract or 1.5. And so the Corbin was a wintertime trade with 1 year, but just in terms of the state of the teams and bringing in a pitcher with that skill set and reputation, definitely felt similar. And the prospects that we gave in that trade, like, we loved them. So it was very difficult to part with them. But as you said, Jory Ortiz, for instance, who's in the trade, I mean, we view him as a major league caliber, ready to go shortstop. But we have many others of those. And so at some point, in order to kind of monetize all this talent, you end up leaning into some trades, even though you feel like you're giving up a lot. And it felt like the right time and the right just the right move for us. And I hope that it works out. But it's definitely if you're able to do it, it's a way to, it's really hard to get your hands on pitchers of his caliber. You're either doling out an enormous free agent contract at some point, or you're developing them, which is very hard to do, or you're doing something like this. And so this was the option available to us. And again, we'll see what it brings, but definitely something that we were excited to do at the time. And I was actually just kind of worried that there weren't going to be any pitchers like that available last winter in the trade market, because Glasnow and Sale got traded, but they're in our division. They're not going to trade them within the division if they can avoid it. And then after that, there really, Burnes was the only other impact starter kind of traded there. So that trade didn't happen until February 1st. So for a while there, I wasn't really sure whether those types of starters were actually going to be on the trade market.
Yeah. So can you walk us through the process of that trade? How long it took, and I guess what dominoes had to line up for that trade to finally happen?
We were talking right out of the gates at the GM meetings, which happened in early November, right after the World Series ends, with any team that we thought or we heard might be putting one of their impact starting pitchers to market, because we knew we had the farm system and you mentioned maybe some redundancies in the farm system. And we also knew that we needed more pitching. So we were pretty aggressive talking to everybody right away. And that included the Brewers and Matt Arnold. And we had a good back and forth early, but it just wasn't clear to me that they were going to trade the guy at all. And as they went through their winter and kind of put their team together, I think they got to a point where they were comfortable entertaining trades for him, but they also have a good team and they wanted to keep that team good in 2024 while also building for the future. And I think we were in a good position because we had big league ready guys that we could put in the trade that were also kind of quote unquote top prospects, even though they were had already debuted and looked very big league ready. So put us in a position to maybe be the only team that could line up with the Brewers and their wants and needs. But it was a lot of conversations, but it really kind of came together very suddenly and quickly in late January, early February, once they sort of decided, okay, we feel like this is the right move for our organization. And I, you know, we'll see what the results are, but at the time I really view it as a very strong trade for both teams, which is always nice to see.
Yeah, and Mike, I mean, I heard one of your interviews talking about the impact of getting a frontline starter, an ace like Corbin Burns. And what was really compelling to me was that you mentioned how it sort of dominoes down throughout your whole pitching staff. And then you actually have pitchers that may be kind of almost like overachieving, you know, like they're actually overqualified for their roles. So can you talk about like the impact of just getting that frontline ace and what it does to the rest of your rotation and stuff?
Yeah, it's not like you said, it's nice because they go to the top of the depth chart and it nudges everybody down. So if you were the number three starter, you're now the number four starter, and then whoever's not cracking the rotation can push into the bullpen and be the long guy and help support the middle part of the bullpen. So that's a big positive. Pitching being pitching, however, you know, we've got like right now John Means is getting off the shelf. Kyle Bradish is hopefully getting off the shelf. So like we've got guys sidelined. So we're not necessarily having an overflow of starting pitchers. We probably never will, the way baseball goes, you know, somebody's always on the IL or whatever, but it's definitely taking pressure off of the other guys that are towards the front end of that rotation who are very young. Grayson Rodriguez, and then, you know, Kyle Bradish not really feeling like he's got to rush back from an injury. I think it's helpful to some of those guys in particular. And then if Corbin does what he's done, which is throw almost 200 innings every year, that radiates out to the bullpen in a big way.
Mike, your team's in the process of being sold. The group's led by David Rubenstein, happens to be a fan of your team and a billionaire, which is kind of a helpful combination of qualities in an owner. What impact do you envision that having? I guess especially in your ability to get some of these young players on your roster signed long-term.
Well, as you mentioned, this not final yet, but you know, we're all following it, and it's in the news, and we're getting plugged in with the new investor group, and all the conversations have been wonderful so far. I love the passion and the fact, as you mentioned, that we've got a really strong presence of people who are from Baltimore in the group, and that's really important if you kind of know Baltimore and the Orioles to have that. he looks like the perfect guy for this, and I'm expecting, you know, I've had support. Our baseball operations department has been incredibly empowered, but from our partnership group, And we've been able to pull off a really strong rebuild because of the support that they've given us. And I'm expecting just kind of more continuity of quality investment. And, you know, in the early parts of our tenure here, that involved draft picks and facilities and farm system and coaches and infrastructure. And that stuff's still important, but increasingly it's morphing more into investment in major league payrolls in some shape or form. So I'm just seeing continuity there. And, you know, certainly the fresh investment, you know, is going to help buttress that in a big way.
You know, I don't want to zip past Jackson Holliday without asking you about him, because I just wrote a story about him last week. And I mean, what an impressive player, what an impressive guy, considering he just turned 20 years old. And it sure felt to me, talking about him with your coaching staff, that it's not out of the question he could make your team. And you know, it wasn't hard to see why. The day I did that story, he hit three balls over 100 miles an hour, stole base, excellent defense at second and short. So am I reading that right, that nobody has closed the door on him making your team at 20?
You know, it's definitely something that we're currently evaluating and watching very carefully. And it involves watching his every move, but also the moves of all the other players that are here trying to make the team too, as we put this roster together. I mean, he's so ahead of the typical curve in anything that he does. And that's obviously what he's done in the minor leagues thus far and what he does on baseball field. But you just look at his life, the maturity that he has, the ease that he has around professional baseball because of his upbringing. He's already married. So just everything that you look at with him, he's kind of beyond his years, and yeah, it's a consistent theme. So we're thrilled that we have him. We're watching him very carefully in terms of what's the right move for us and for him going into 2024. But this is also somebody that has a incredible chance to be a exceptionally accomplished player over a very long time. And we've got to think about, is his development going to be aborted as well? So these are all huge considerations, and it all kind of goes in a pot and is stirred up as you're thinking about a decision of how to develop a talent like this. And, you know, we'll talk throughout the rest of spring training, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, I've learned, and I think Brandon Hyde's learned, we kind of take things one day at a time in baseball, because something might happen. And if you stress out about the future too much and somebody gets hurt or something comes down the pike that you weren't anticipating, it can change the calculus on almost anything. So we're real day by day in spring training.
It sounded like a great like soup recipe. You know, he's a stir, you know, all these prospects. And I mean, what do you do when you have like between like Westberg, Henderson and Holliday, you literally could throw them at second, short, third base? Like, I mean, what does that feel like to just have that revolving door of ability to put these guys in all these situations at this age?
It's obviously great because they're all so talented and they're so athletic that they can move around. You know, we've got a nice blend of left-handed infielders and right-handed infielders, which is really helpful because if we're resting one night, you can do it based on matchups and you can mix and match the lineups. I think it's Brandon does a nice job with that. But the positional flexibility, you know, comes with some costs, and it's the players have to work at multiple positions and move around the diamond, and your body feels different some days, and it's not without its costs. So it's great that those guys can do that. Obviously, the modern game places a lot of value on players that are able to do that, and I think this generation of players right now is really motivated to have that type of versatility because it's helpful for their careers. But you know, it's something you have to be thoughtful about so that we're not wearing somebody down or confusing a young player, you know, screwing up his development because we're getting a little too creative there. But these guys through the minors, they've played multiple positions, they have the physical tools to move around the diamond and play those three infield positions well. And, you know, we'll take advantage of it the best that we can.
Mike, I don't want to let you run before we talk a little about your own story in the game. I know that you started your journey working in the phone center as an intern in the Phillies ticket office. So did you know then you were destined to be the general manager of a major league team like everybody else around you in that internship program?
That's your good Phillies dope there, Jason.
Yeah,
that's,
right?
That's good info. Yeah, I had a nice time doing that. I believe A.J. Preller was also in the same, and Mike Daly, and there's been a few other people that a guy named Phil Feather ran the internship program for the Phillies, and that was my first job in baseball while I was rehabbing from a shoulder surgery in college. I did that kind of knowing that I wanted to work in baseball and just get some type of work experience in professional baseball. And yeah, we sold tickets on the phone, and it was fun.
Yeah, I love to ask people, when you were an intern, what was the most fun thing you did or the craziest thing you did? Eric Neander told us a story about having to like get into one of the boxes on that press level, right? He had to climb out of the box he was in and go along the like one of those catwalks and then climb back in. Did you ever have anything like that when you were an intern?
Yeah, you know, it was this was 2003 and 2003, 2004 kind of off season, and the Phillies were not only moving out of the vet that winter, but they were moving out of the spring training. It was all new facilities. And so I got to work in the vet, and then I got to work in Citizens Bank Park for like a little bit right when it opened. But the vet, we had to like clean it out and get stuff out of the closets and stuff so that we could move it, looking for files and all that. And that was rough. You didn't know what was going to jump out at you while you were doing that. But I was one of the last people to walk out of Veterans Stadium and have a picture on the elevator with the Philly fanatic carrying some boxes out of the stadium. And so that's a fun one to look at from time to time.
So good.
Well, did you were you there for the very first walk off home run hit at Citizens Bank Park?
I was only in the winter time. I was there for like 6 months or something, and it wasn't around for the regular season. So we moved into the building, the new offices, and I left in January, February, and I went and worked for Tom House, the renowned pitching coach out in San Diego. And it was right when my rehab was starting to get back into the throwing phase. So it was a great year.
Gee, I wonder why Doug would ask that question. I wonder who hit that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, it was you?
I don't know.
I didn't know that.
That's true.
Can we look that up, Doug? Do you remember who hit it?
I don't remember. I know Rocky Biddle was pitching for the Expos. Yeah. I do remember.
It's funny how you remember who was pitching. Just can't put your finger on who was hitting. Might have been you, but maybe not. Who knows? Mike, one last thing. You kind of touched on this. You've done your building. You've gone from 100 losses to 100 wins. So the next step is to win, to keep this together. And here's a question that always fascinates me. Which is harder, this where you're at now or trying to build toward this?
Well, the building, it's not fun, especially, you know, if you're the major league manager and the focus is on the minors and the infrastructure and building up the capabilities of the organization for a few years. That's not pleasant. But like I was saying, the Houston experience kind of helped steel me for that. And then, you know, now we're in a phase where we've got all these young players meshing together, and this is very enjoyable, but I think it's going to be very challenging to keep this group at the top of the American League East because of the quality of our opponents. The division itself is just very, very taxing with everything you do, anything that you analyze when you're in the AL East and you've got five great organizations in there. It just kind of puts a dampening effect on your hopes with every move just because your competition's so stiff. So that's going to be tough. And then, you know, Baltimore is not a large market, and baseball's got tremendous market disparities that affect the way the teams have to do business. And so we've got challenges on the horizon to maintain this level of play or some semblance of this. But, you know, there's organizations out there that do it. Tampa does it in the American League East. They've done it for almost like 20 years now. So it's possible, but it's difficult. And I think it's going to be a big challenge.
Well, Mike, your team is special. It's been special having you here on this show. Can't tell you how much we appreciate your taking the time to visit us in the middle of another busy spring training day. So please come back again sometime, like maybe after you win the World Series.
That'd be good.
Sounds good.
I'll take that as an excuse to come back on the show. Okay. But thank you for having me. A lot of fun.
Yeah, we enjoyed it, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
All right, it's that time again. It's time for Listener Trivia, our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. Doug, our trivia streak is still alive. We have gotten at least one question right in every month since the start of 2023. So I'm starting to wonder about this. Where do you think this streak ranks among the most memorable streaks in sports history? Are we there yet with UConn women's hoops, Cal Ripken, the Harlem Globetrotters over the Washington Generals? Are we in that conversation?
We have to be. I mean, Joe DiMaggio, Pete Rose, other streaks, maybe the days I've eaten French toast for breakfast. We are in all these categories, so I feel very good about it.
Okay, well, let's hope we still feel good about it as we go along here. Because you know what? In trivia, you're only as good as your next question. That's good baseball trivia talk for you there, Doug. Okay, so we got one this week that's going to test us, but that's okay. It's what we are here for. So let's see how smart we are this week. Let's bring in this week's special trivia guest star. It's Reggie Deal. Reggie, welcome to Starkville.
Thank you for having me. Let's make sure the voice is in good working order, and good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So Reggie, you actually emailed us this question. This is proof we really do read our email. Were you wondering about that when you sent in the question?
No, I figured that was my best shot because I actually abandoned the platform formerly known as the Bird some months ago. So
you gave the Bird the Bird? I can't believe it.
I guess I went Albert Bell on the owner of that platform. Yeah.
We got an Albert Bell reference, Doug. It's good. You know, Reggie, we always enjoy letting our trivia guest stars introduce themselves to our listeners. So why don't you tell everybody where you're from and what team you root for?
So I actually have an interesting baseball backstory. I did not grow up in a baseball-loving family, and I'm also blind. So I learned the game on the radio.
Wow.
In the 80s. And so my first major league game was a Braves Astros game in the in the Houston Astrodome in 1991, and it turned out that three future Hall of Famers played in that game because Bagwell and Biggio were both playing for the Astros, and one of the Braves pitchers, and I can't remember if it was Glavin or Smoltz in that game, but one of them was on the mound in that game.
Oof!
So that was my first major league game in June of 91. And it just kind of took on a life of its own after that. I've actually been to every major league ballpark. In fact, I did a ballpark odyssey back in 2012. There was actually a write-up that MLB.com just the time when I did that. So my wife says that everything for me revolves around baseball, and she's probably right.
Well, we can relate to that. What a cool story. Tremendous. So we really appreciate your joining us. But now is the time to get down to business. So, Reggie, why don't you hit us with your question, which I would guess we will definitely get wrong.
So, in 2023, of course, Ronald Acuna won the MVP for the National League, and he led the league in stolen bases. Now, there have been four previous National League MVPs who led the league in stolen bases in their MVP season. I won't make you name the two in the American League. Those were Ricky Henderson for the 1990 Athletics and Ichiro Suzuki for the 2001 Mariners. But can you name the four previous NL MVPs who were the league leaders in stolen bases in their MVP season?
Wow.
I'll give you one clue. All four of these are prior to the divisional era.
They're prior to the divisional era. Okay. We would have had a better shot at Ichiro and Reggie and Ricky, but whatever. Doug, I don't know how I'll ever get this, but if we had any hope, so I think it's you and employing your devious new cheating scheme, Operation Multiple Choice. So four answers, luckily, puts us over the Glanville line. I'm going to let you and Reggie negotiate what we need to do to claim, however dubiously, that we got this question right.
Yes, well, thank you for entertaining this, Reggie. Well, actually, I've simplified the Operation Multiple Choice. So I said it's an offer to be either make the four guesses but only have to get three, or make five guesses and have to get four. So that's it. That's my new thing. Either get the full number with one extra guess, or guess the number and just have one less required guess correct.
Well, since the theme of the question is stolen bases, and since modern baseball analytics says that you should not steal unless you are successful at least 75% of the time, I'll settle for three out of four.
Three out of four. Okay, that sounds good. Three out of four. I'm not sure if it'll help, but it sounds good.
Wait, what is the divisional era anyway? What year is that?
69. 1969 onwards.
So before 1969?
Oh, wow. That's right. So, Doug, I do know one of these for sure. Maury Wills, the year he stole 104 bases for the Dodgers, made history, broke the record. I'm sure he won the MVP that year. So that's one. I think Lou Brock is another guy who did this. He stole, was it 96 for the Cardinals? And I'm pretty sure Lou Brock won an MVP at some point. He was in my Stark Truth book. So that gives us two. But then, I don't know, this gets pretty much impossible, at least for me. I wrote down some other names, but most of them, they're from the divisional era, so I wish I'd known this. The only one I've got left is Willie Mays. I know that Willie Mays won at least one stolen base title, and he should have won about nine MVP awards. So the question is whether he won an actual MVP award in a season when he led the league in steals. But I think he's a great guess. But like, I'll be honest, that's really about all I've got. I'm going to turn this over to you, man. You were a base stealer. Try to see if you can help us pick the third name and the fourth name.
The amazing thing is I have the dark horse with a lot of confidence because I've spent so much of my life researching this man.
Oh, really?
But I'm pretty confident Jackie Robinson is one of those answers. Because when he won the MVP award, I'm pretty sure he led the league in stolen bases.
Yeah. A couple times. That's an excellent guess.
Okay. I feel great about that. But so I'm just trying to think of base stealers, and it gets so murky when the leaders had 30 and 27.
I know, exactly.
But I mean, I have, as soon as you mentioned before 69, I just wrote down Brock and Wills right away, just like probably those guys. But, you know, I don't know if there's some dark horse. Willie Mays, obviously a grand. So I don't know. Did Clemente win something? And I mean, he could run a little bit. And,
I think we've actually got four good guesses now. We can thrash around a little bit like we do best, but I think we've got four good guesses. You want to just guess?
Yeah. I mean, I think those are great guesses. I'll jump right in.
All right. Okay. So, I don't know if Operation Multiple Choice is going to save us or whether we just somehow got this right, but let's take our shot. Reggie, is there any chance it is Maury Wills, Lou Brock, Jackie Robinson, and or Willie Mays?
Well, you're right about the two Dodgers. Robinson in 49 with 37 stolen bases, and you mentioned Wills in 62. Wrong Cardinal, though. The other two actually were the first two MVPs in the league. Frankie Frisch for the 31 Cardinals had 28 stolen bases to lead the National League. And Chuck Klein led the National League with 20 in 1932.
20?
Chuck Klein.
For the Phillies.
Wow, it never crossed my mind.
I actually almost threw Frankie Frisch, but I was like, he's like 20s, though. There's no way.
Yeah, wow.
I would have never confidently put him on that list.
When I first researched this question, Brock and Mays were on my list, and Mays won an MVP, but it was later. He did not lead the league in steals in his MVP year.
Right, should have won that year. But
and when I thought Brock had won the MVP the year he stole like 118, he didn't, and he did not win an MVP in any of the years when he was the league leader in the National League.
Wow!
Oh,
great.
I feel like we gave this an excellent effort, Doug.
Excellent. You know, excellent. Very proud.
Okay, to steal this one, you got to get a bigger lead than we got. But where do you think we went wrong? I don't feel that bad.
No, I mean Frankie Frisch is always my like way out there answer, but I would have never confidently picked Frankie Frisch over Willie Mays or Lou Brock. So I feel like those were the best answers we could have thrown out there.
Yeah, we did what we had to do. It just wasn't enough to keep our streak alive, but March is not over. Thank God. Either way, you know, at times like this, we do what we do best. And that, of course, is stop talking. So we could turn this segment over to someone not named us. That, of course, would be the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, to play another sensational play-by-play clip involving this week's answers. So, Tim, I can't wait to hear your Frankie Frisch soundbite.
You're going to have to keep waiting on that one, Jason. I think I tried to find you guys used to answer Frankie Frisch every week. For the trivia, there was a stretch of time.
We
I think at one
there,
point I did. Tried to find one. We're not going with Frankie Frisch. We are going with Maury Wills. He stole 104 bases in 1962 when he won that MVP award. This one, not one of the 104. He wasn't just the MVP of the league, though. He was the MVP of the All-Star game as well. Here he is doing his thing in the sixth inning of that Midsummer Classic.
Fastball ready, there goes Wills. The pitch hung on and missed, and batty makes no throw to second base. It's a clean steal by Maury Wills. Pasquale pitching with Wills at second base. Nobody out. Two-strike pitch coming to Grote. Swung on, hit up the middle. A base hit on into center field. Around third, coming to the plate is Wills. And the National League leads 1-0.
It was a scoreless game in the sixth inning. Stan Musial singles. Maury Wills pinch runs. Steals second base. Scores the go-ahead run.
Wow. And there's nothing I love more than an audio clip that sounds like a guy was shouting into a tin can. It's magic.
The man shouting into the tin can there. The broadcast team was John McClain and Lindsey Nelson.
Yeah, of course it was. All right. Hey, Reggie, that was an excellent, excellent question, my friend.
Great question, Reggie. Right,
really made us think. As we saw, that's always dangerous. But great work by you. Please come back and visit us again in Starkville, okay?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Thank you.
Sliding, catching, and going into the dugout.
You know, even in spring training, it's good for our baseball souls to know that somewhere, wherever he is, the dugout is still open. That, as you know, is where we could find our friend Doug Glanville, telling his famous stories about baseball, about life, to whoever will listen. That's usually us. Okay, so Doug, if I remember this right, this week you were inspired by Joey Votto walking into a strange clubhouse in spring training after all those years of walking into the same clubhouse. I mean, you did a little of that yourself late in your career. So what did that remind you of?
Well, Jay, I mean, there's no doubt that walking into a clubhouse, first of all, there's an excitement because the possibility, and that certainly changes over time, as you know, going from the rookie to the veteran. Well, when you're at Joey Votto's stage, it's a little scary because you feel like the power is no longer in your hands, even though it probably never was. You know, you realize that, you know, some decision makers say, hey, you don't fit. We already have a left-handed, you know, offense hitter. We already have someone at your position. Or you go, you know, 1-for-17 and that's it. So you never know what's going to rear its ugly head with aging in this game. And I think back to a couple of situations. One is when I went to Texas in 2003. That was late in my career. I was 32 turning 33. I'd been very comfortable in Philadelphia for many years before that. And it was a tough offseason because I lost my father. And so that was a different experience of just playing baseball without my dad and just trying to reset around something different. I was in the American League for the first time and walking in with the DH and all these things. So that took a minute. But, you know, it was something that was betting on myself. It was a one-year deal. I said, let's see what I got. And he walked into that clubhouse and that year was the first year of surprise. So that was where Texas and Kansas City actually share the same complex. So it was like everything was new. You know, I was like, okay, I'm trying to figure this out. So in some ways that helped me because everybody was still trying to figure out this facility. And I knew I had A-Rod and Palmeiro and Juan Gonzalez, these really great hitters. And I was thinking, I might score 200 runs if I can just get on base. So there was a lot of excitement. And then Chan Ho Park kind of ruined a little bit it because I sat with Chan Ho my first day of lunch, you know, and whatever, we had lunch break. And I sat across from Chan Ho. And I'm like, this is our ace. You know, he's a pretty good pitcher. I faced him in L.A. And he said, hey, Doug, man, like, do you remember what I throw? Like, what do I have? What kind of pitches do I have? Are they good? I was like, we're in trouble. We're done. We're like, this is our ace. We are done. So I was like, yeah, Chan Ho, you threw like 98. Remember the slider, you know, the slurve, you know? He was like, I don't know what I have. So I'm like, okay. So, but it was fun meeting, you know, I was excited to play with A-Rod because I was like, this is like the greatest player I've seen. And I wanted to see what, you know, what he did and his work ethic. And he had, you know, great work ethic. He hit off the curveball machine. So I think the newness of being old but new, that was cool. It was revitalizing. It kind of made me focus. And I think Joey Votto has that, like, wait a minute, I'm always Cincinnati. Like, now I got to do something different. Get out of your comfort and you can fall into place. And then so by the next year, I was, you know, went back to Philly. And then now I was the old guy in 2005. And I went to Yankee camp. And the thing about the Yankees, storied franchise, grew up outside in New York. You know, everything that sort of you think of, Reggie and 70s and 80s and Dave Winfield living in my hometown of Teaneck. And I just had a lot of connections, of course, with the Yankees. And it was a little risky because it was Yankees or bust. I was like, this is it. And, you know, I could have gone, you know, maybe to Tampa or somewhere a little safer, maybe. Probably would have been a better choice because I got released. But I went for it. And, you know, it was different because now I had to kind of find a new culture, you know, the clean shaven, the Yankee storied history, you know, focus. And the first day I walked in the clubhouse, I had my red Phillies bag from all those years packed with stuff. I put it in my locker. The whole staff like descended on it. Like there was like something ticking in it or something. I mean, they were like, what is that? They flew over, they ripped the bag out, took it in the back, took all my stuff out of it, put it in a Yankee bag and then put it back. They said, we cannot have enemy colors in here, only Yankee colors. That's it. So I was like, this place is serious. So So, you know, so I appreciated that. But once again, the culture shift. Every team, every year, every manager, different culture, different style. And that's a challenge. It's even a challenge when you're repeating in the same organization, but it's really a challenge when you're going to a different league, a different style, you know, champions, free agent, and trying to figure it out. So I know Votto will you know, figure it out. I think it's part of the thing that kind of keeps you alive, keeps your blood flowing in this game. But you're always trying to stave off the inevitable. And you know, one day, you're going to have to hang it up. And you're never really ready for it.
Yeah. You know, I told Joey yesterday that I feel like change is good. Change is invigorating. He actually used that word, invigorating, later when he was doing a little press briefing. So I know he bought into it. But it was cool to see that with my own eyes. And it was cool to hear you talk about it because just the way Joey Votto did with me, your story just reminded me that so often, like, these tales that you tell, that guys tell, that we all tell, they're not really about baseball. They're about life. And nobody taps into that better than you. So, Doug, we're lucky to have you around holding court on the streets of Starkville. Okay, that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all spring training long on The Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And you know what? If you'd like to read about Joey Votto or check out any of the awesome spring training coverage in The Athletic, we can tell you how to do that. Just go to theathletic.com/baseballshow. And if you're a new subscriber, you can subscribe for just $2 a month for the next 12 months. Yes, I said $2. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast. Every show, we pick a fun listener trivia question, and then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove, once again, there's almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong. So to do that, you can do what Reggie Deal did and email us at Starkville@theathletic.com. Starkville has an E on the end. Or you can check out my Facebook fan page where, again, this week we got a bunch of fun questions. Or you can do what most people do and fire those questions at us on X, which historians tell us was once called Twitter. You know, Doug, historians tell us you were once called Doug Glanville. So how would people locate Doug Glanville on X?
Well, you know what, Jay, I also have an E at the end
That's
of
right.
my name.
It's not a coincidence, by the way.
Passion. But do not mistake that for making an error on the field. Okay, we don't want that.
No
E in that regard. But yes, I can be found all over the place. I use my name. It's very simple. So at symbol, and then spell my name out, D-O-U-G, and then go to the last name part, G-L-A-N-V-I-L-L-E. Put it together, you got at Doug Glanville, Twitter, whatever you're called, X, doesn't matter. You will find
Every week, Doug spells his full name so perfectly. It's just a talent that he's got. But you don't have to spell my full name to find me on X, because I am at Jason S-T, J-A-Y-S-O-N-S-T. You should also hashtag those questions, hashtag StarkvilleQS. So, Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Mike Elias for visiting us. Thanks to Reggie Deal for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Doug and I will see you soon.
Starkville.